It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we continue our summer music series, Setlist. Today, we'll feature Milo, a rapper from Milwaukee whose music some have defined as art rap.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Governor Walker made headlines a couple times this week. First, when he unveiled his idea for a health care plan if he were to be elected president. And again, when the Marquette Law Poll came out yesterday reflecting his approval rating.
At the Capitol, legislators are considering a bill that would reform the state's current John Doe laws.
And an audit by the Legislative Audit Bureau this week found no major problems with Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board.
For the latest on these stories, we're joined by Mark Pitch, state news editor for the Wisconsin State Journal. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Good afternoon.
So early in the week, Governor Walker announced a health care policy he would implement if he became president. Here's a clip from that speech.
We provide a tax credit that's tied into age. It's not tied into income, so it applies across the board. As people get older, it goes up.
So, Mark, what exactly is Governor Walker suggesting?
So there's a couple of different ideas behind this plan. One, as the clip mentioned, he would provide tax credits for people who don't have employer insurance to buy private coverage, and that would be based on age instead of income. Currently, Obamacare law provides such subsidies according to income. He's also proposing that the federal government send block grants to states to cover necessary families under Medicaid. He's also talking about having consumers shopping for health care insurance across state lines, which is prohibited currently.
So it sounds like this would be a fairly significant departure from the Affordable Care Act and the provisions that it has.
Yes and no, I guess. He's calling for a repeal of Obamacare, but in some ways, some of the thematic ideas, you know, such as these tax credits, are consistent with the current law, but he puts his own twist on it.
So Governor Walker's campaign has come out and said that he needs to be more aggressive. You know, there's a very large field of Republican candidates for president right now. Would you say that this example of kind of coming out swinging on health care might reflect that new attitude?
I think the campaign itself would acknowledge that. The governor has said that this is just the first in a series of policy proposals that he's going to offer that other candidates seeking the presidency, or at least the 2016 Republican nomination, haven't been making. One of our reporters, Matt DeFore, is currently working on a story that will be published Sunday that will point out that, you know, they're working on tax policy, they're working on economic growth, they're working on foreign policy. He's going to roll out a series of these over the coming weeks, and I would anticipate seeing, you know, at least two or three more before the next Republican presidential debate in mid-September.
So yesterday, Marquette Law School released their most recent poll, and the Governor Walker approval rating dropped since April. What can you tell us about the governor's image here in Wisconsin?
Well, those poll numbers say it all. Poll director Charles Franklin said that the fact that just 39% of registered voters in his poll approve of Walker's job performance show that he's, quote, notably underwater. It's the lowest approval rating since the Marquette poll began asking Wisconsin voters about this in January of 2011. Would it have been even lower during the Act 10 protests? In the Act 10 legislation, perhaps. Nonetheless, the governor was elected, reelected last fall, won three elections, as he likes to point out, in 4 years, by a pretty healthy margin. And to see an approval rating below 40% certainly is remarkable.
So, in other news this week, an audit by the Republican-led Legislative Audit Bureau found that the state's Government Accountability Board had no major problems. What was the purpose of this audit in the first place?
The, The Republican legislature has been skeptical of the job of the GAB for the last few years. They've asked the nonpartisan audit bureau to undertake a number of different audits of the GAB. This one looked into how the board handles complaints that have been registered with the accountability board. And these are complaints that are generally kept private until disciplinary action is actually taken. And what the audit found was that there were no major problems in the way that the Government Accountability Board was doing its work. It said that they reviewed close to 1,900 complaints.
So this was actually the second audit in less than a year that failed to uncover any major problems. Did the previous audit do much to change opinions at the Capitol?
The Republicans' concerns with the GAB have been longstanding. They date back to how the board handled recall elections in 2011 and in 2012, the design of ballots for the 2014 elections, and certainly the GAB's role in the ongoing John Doe investigation into campaign finance regulation. So it's unlikely that these audits are going to change the minds of the folks at the legislature, and we would anticipate seeing the legislature take up changes to the GAB sometime this fall.
So in just the last 30 seconds or so that we have, the State Assembly has added a bill to their agenda to talk about reforming the state's John Doe laws, which you just mentioned. Why is this bill being talked about now, and what's the next step for the Assembly?
Well, the legislature wants to change the process of investigating campaign finance violations using the secret John Doe process. The Judiciary Committee in the Assembly passed the measure on a 3-2 vote this week. It's also passed out of the Senate, and it'll go to the floor at some time again, we would expect, this fall.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Mark Pitch, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for asking.
Mark Pitch is a state news reporter, or editor, sorry, for the Wisconsin State Journal, giving us the latest on the biggest news stories from around the state this week.
We continue our summer music series, Setlist. We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which will air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Milwaukee rapper Rory Ferreira, also known as Milo, has lived on both coasts before eventually calling Wisconsin home.
He recently dropped by the WPR studios to play some new material and talk about how his grandfather and having patience for the writing process have influenced his music. All right, Rory, thanks a lot for coming in and playing for us in studio today.
Thank you for having me and my friends. Appreciate it.
First of all, I want to talk about what I've read that people call your style of rap. People are calling it art rap. How do you define what art rap is?
Art rap, my understanding of it is just, rappers who understand that our tradition, our music, hip-hop, rap, whatever you want to call it, is a continuation of styles that date back to the blues and so on. They're born from a lineage, and it's important to keep that context in mind when you're analyzing its tropes and styles and whatnot. And art rap is kind of just trying to reclaim a certain amount of power from people who write about our music. Sometimes they mean well or something like that, and might use a term like conscious rap or something, but it's kind of like, that suggests maybe a superiority that no one claims to have. So art rap is this term that my friend Open Mike Eagle came up with to describe, rap that's aware of a historical tradition.
Oh, okay. When rapping in the attic of a square apartment felt like rapping in Madison Square Garden, and you were very happy to be there. 2 feet perpendicular on your square, proud and attentive, never loud and inventive. Your style's been incentivized. Your personality is an app on this here mobile device. You spent your whole
life. It sounds like you could have gone a lot of different ways when I've read about the interests you've had, German philosophers and Spanish poets, but then like Pokemon and wrestlers. How did you decide to take all that, synthesize it, and put it into rap?
Well, I guess honestly, since it's a capitalist society, I have to make a commodity. I have to, sell something to make money. And so rap and the rules of rap allow those kind of bizarre knowledge pools to be combined into something of worth and merit. So I don't know. It just kind of seemed natural, I guess I'll say. I can't think of anything else that allows you to be into, you know, German philosophy and Spanish poets and wrestling and Pokemon, and that's pretty cool.
And you grew up in Maine, right? And you spent time living a lot of places, but I've read that Maine is where you did most of your growing up. Is that right?
Yeah, Maine and Chicago.
And you said I come from nowhere.
It's more because I've just, by the time I graduated high school, I'd been to like 13 schools. So it's hard for me to feel like I'm from any one place. And I mean, the older I got and the more into like other musicians and other philosophies, like, you know, Sun Ra is big on this idea of black folks as the living myth, you know, that we are from no place and that we have no place of our own. So I just kept saying that, even though the meaning kind of changed a little bit for me. But I just say I'm from no place because with airplanes and the internet, it's all one place anyway.
That's interesting, though, because a lot of musicians, they want to really get their music to focus on where they're from, and you can hear it and you see it in their videos, and they write about stuff that they see in their hometown. Do you have that, or do you consider yourself for real like a world citizen?
I don't feel like I belong too much to any one place. I live in Milwaukee presently, and I love it there because of the people and other things that aren't so geographic, so I don't know.
I love rappers how shepherds love sheep for wool. It's easy for me to say this place isn't beautiful. It's easy for me to say that this place isn't beautiful.
You started your own label. Why did you decide to go that route instead of a traditional model trying to get noticed by a bigger label?
That's so cool that you said that. Thank you for saying that. Ruby Yacht is the label that I started, and we really advocate artist involvement on every level of production. So we're dubbing our own tapes, making our own shirts and patches, and making all of our own beats. You know, we're really into that, and kind of like a holistic community and making art from a community oriented space. So it's like right now my friends came in and performed with me as Milo, and you know, sometimes my friends, we perform as, you know, whatever, Safari Owl or someone else, and we really like that approach, that sort of group operating under one person's aesthetic and structure. And I just don't know of a label that is supportive of that kind of approach, so I guess we had to make our own.
Do people see what you're doing and go, that's a model that has some legs, I want to do that instead?
I mean, that's the exact response, actually, is people are extremely interested in your music when you value it accordingly. You know, when people see that, we're making the beats, mixing it, mastering it, dubbing it ourselves, stenciling the J cards, you know, putting the seal on each one, packing them up, like, suddenly there's an interest, right? Like, what is that? Why are you doing that? Why do you care that much about your own product? I mean, I know it's very popular right now to give out your music for free in rap, and we just don't believe in that at all.
Where do you start when you're writing something?
Mm-hmm.
And what are you thinking of when you're putting it all down?
I mean, for me, it's interesting. Writing a song, it starts with a feeling. I'm very bizarre when I start songwriting. I have to kind of hide and like protect myself. I have to like form the room in such a way that I can catch this feeling. And that's really all I can describe it as. I don't know. It's just a headspace. And then from there, the song just comes in an hour or so, and I just move on. But I don't know, such an extreme paranoia takes over me when I'm writing.
Wait, what kind of paranoia?
You know, a lot of the ideas in my music are very fragile, or maybe I don't have the best language to say them. Maybe there is no best language to even say them. And so I'm just so worried about putting those ideas in the hands of clumsy thinkers. I mean, almost every album is a good example of that. But I guess there's a song, my friend Alex Safari Owl, who played with me, he and I have a song from my first mixtape that, I don't know, the idea was, what if two guys who were in love with each other wrote a rap song about one another and then rapped it to one another? And then, you know, we just thought that was interesting. And so we did that. And then we put it out, and, you know, just clumsy thinkers, people who can't pause a reaction. I guess that's what I mean, reactionary. Like, It's incredibly rare now for people to just sit and digest a thing and just not have an opinion. You know, just, I need to take some time, because it's like, it takes a long time to make a song or an album or whatever. And even like in rap, nobody ever is trying to analyze or understand or appreciate process. You know, how was it made? Especially with something like the example I gave you. Like, why would these guys write a song like that?
Do you ever respond to people like that?
No, I don't. I just find it's best to keep it moving and be a forward-thinking fellow. It's easy for me to get real down, so I just have to avoid all that stuff, yeah.
Well, honestly, who could say? I remember the art museum where Mike Eagle found Dubuffet. I remember Meredith blessing me with Jean Genet and blowing my old life kisses bombs away. I remember packing an apartment into three bags and driving across God's kneecaps to Lord knows where. I'm more bored than scared. How I learned to portion the orphan share or be the burden bearer. Working titles of my autobiography. I'm probably not the rapper for you. Listen to the Method Man song, but act like my dad is asking the questions. Is it real, son? Is it really real, son? Do you know the deal, son? Is it really real? Something I could feel, son. Want it raw deal, son. Load it up and kill one. Is it really real? Is it really real? Is it really real?
It seems like you've got to be a big reader, just based on the places you go in your songs.
Thank you.
What you're thinking about, the poetry that influences you, the philosophy. Are you someone who reads a lot?
I read a lot, yeah. I read a whole lot. It's a big thing in my family is, like, my parents had me when they were both younger than I am now. I'm 23. They both dropped out of high school. So, like, in my family, it was like, you know, this is how you learn, Rory. Like, we don't have money, you know, like there's no money, but there's books everywhere. And my mother really set like the greatest example for that in my life. And she still does. Like, my mom will still call me up weekly. Like, what you reading? I just read this. And it's cool. And it's like, I have a little sister who's about to be 10 and she's in it. And it's just like, it's a big family thing for us. Reading is very important.
What are you reading right now?
Right now, I just started rereading this collection of poems that's Pablo Neruda and Cesar Vallejo, and I've had it for a while, and I kind of, you know, was like leaning very heavily on the Pablo side, and then on a train ride recently I realized the Vallejo side had some depth. So yeah, I've been kind of re-exploring that lately.
What they talking about?
Nuclear war.
I guess it's nuclear war. What they talking about? I guess it's nuclear war.
Tell me about Cavalcade.
Cavalcade. Oh, man. Cavalcade. Okay, so one of the major constellations in my life, I guess you would say, is my grandfather. And just growing up in Chicago and being at his house a lot, he would always be playing America. And it kind of became like a joke in my family as I got older, like this old black guy from Arkansas who only ever listens to John Denver in America. And so my family, I know a lot of John Denver in America, and I've always used that as like a social bargaining chip in odd situations, you know, like, ah, well, but do you like, you know, Ventura Highway or whatever? And someone's like, ah, you like America. So Cavalcade, all the songs, it's a free mixtape. They all sample different America songs, and it's an album for my grandfather, who is a philosopher and a reverend and just an extremely inspired man. And I wanted to make him something while he was here on this planet to know how much I love him and appreciate him and how much I value his legacy, I guess, inside of me.
Did he get to hear it?
Yeah, he loves it. He plays it. He'll text me. Well, he texts me every day, no matter what, but he'll text me at random some nights and be like, I'm playing my version of Horse With No Name. I love it. Da, 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 da. It's cool. Yeah, it's
ingratiated myself to the fools and jesters. Learned from my errors and called my mom a lie. Cried in a couple coffee shops. It's all love like Micah 9. I'ma get mine, don't trip. I'ma get mine, don't trip. It's all love like Micah 9. I'ma get mine, don't trip. I'ma get mine, don't trip. It's all love.
And last question, here's an easy one for you. Where did the name Milo come from?
Oh, cool. Milo came from a children's book called The Phantom Tollbooth. And I chose the name because I was in a rap group called Nom de Rap, and I needed a rap name for the other members to reference, you know? And at the time, I was reading The Phantom Tollbooth, and the first page just describes this boy who's so like kind of icky. He's kind of irritable and likes to be in his room a lot and is a complainer by nature. And I was just like, yeah, that's what I do with my music. So that's me. And I took it.
Awesome. Well, Rory, thank you.
Thank you very
so much for coming and playing and talking today.
Appreciate it.
That's why we have to write so many rap songs. Brothers like us don't live too long. That's why we have to write so many rap songs. Brothers like us don't live too long. That's why we have to write so many rap songs. Brothers like us don't live too long.
The Menominee Tribe in Wisconsin voted this week to legalize medicinal and recreational marijuana use on its lands. The decision to hold a vote came after a 2014 announcement by the U.S. Justice Department, which could give some tribes the okay to grow and sell marijuana on reservations.
The decision brings up a number of legal issues about how the tribe might implement a growing and selling operation and when they'll get started.
We're joined now by the chairman of the Menominee Tribe, Gary Bisa. Gary, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And also Richard Monette is joining us. Richard is a law professor and the director of the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center. Richard, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, Gary, let's start with you. What sparked the tribe's decision to hold a vote now on legalizing the use and sale of marijuana?
Well, after the United States Department of Justice sent out a memo, they call it the Cole memo, that talked about a way to satisfy the dilemma of states that had legalized marijuana when it is still illegal federally, the U.S. Department of Justice sent a memo to all of the U.S. attorney generals, and they said they could apply the following guidelines to the land that the districts that they had federal jurisdiction over. And when tribal nations saw that, they said, what about us? We're in essence sovereign nations. What would you do, U.S. Department of Justice, if we also had legalized marijuana within our reservation? And that kind of started that ball rolling, that in essence they said, well, almost similar to how we might give the discretion to prosecute to that U.S. Attorney General if that state, for instance, Colorado, met certain guidelines or stayed within certain guidelines as they developed their regulatory system and it was rigorous enough, and they made sure, for instance, that in selling, growing and processing and selling marijuana in Colorado, that they made sure that it wasn't getting into the hands of minors, there wasn't drug driving involved, that it wasn't leaving the state of Colorado where it was legal and going into states where it is illegal, let's say Kansas. So they said fairly similar to that could happen with tribal governments. That's what the U.S. Department of Justice told the U.S. Attorney Generals, and in our case, it would be the U.S. Attorney General in the Eastern District of Wisconsin who has that federal jurisdiction over the part of the state that we live in.
So let me turn to Richard for a moment. So Richard, the legal arguments of jurisdiction, state versus federal jurisdiction on reservations can be confusing. Can you explain to us how the Menominee Tribe differs from the other tribes in Wisconsin in this respect?
Yeah, I can give you the 2-minute version. And really sort of 5 points to keep in mind. The first point to remember is that the states did not originally have this kind of jurisdiction over tribes at all. And it's important to start there because people think that naturally the states have it and somehow Menominee's working some sort of exception or exemption. And of course there'd have to be something accepted or exempted from, right? And that's not the case here. So That's the starting point. The second and third starting points are in 1953, Congress passed two acts. One was called the Termination Act, and the other is roughly called an Assimilation Act that we refer to by the federal law number, Public Law 83-280, or in the short, we just say 280. And Menominee was the only tribe in the state subjected to the Termination Act. It terminated the legal and political relationship between the tribe and the United States. And it was a miserable experiment to start with.
And why were the Menominee singled out?
Because the idea was that they were capable of sustaining themselves. They had a robust timbering industry. They had some other things going on. And the thought was that if they no longer had this special relationship, they would thrive quite well in the regular world. It didn't turn out that way for a variety of reasons, most of which were not Menominee's fault. So the other 1953 Act transferred criminal jurisdiction or gave criminal jurisdiction to the state of Wisconsin, and it did that only to five or six states. Those second and third points are very important to remember and to keep in mind. So if we fast forward 18 years, in 1971, the Menominee tribe sought and got a restoration of their legal and political relationship. And in the course of that happening, Wisconsin recognized that both the termination and assimilation laws had been miserable failures. And so Wisconsin agreed that if Menominee's relationship was restored, that Menominee would not be subject to the Second Act, to PL 280. So today,
which would have put them under the state jurisdiction along with those other tribes.
In criminal jurisdiction, that's right. So that's sort of that 1971 is the fourth important point. There's one more important point, and then we can go on to other questions. But it is important to remember that regarding the second 1953 Act, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has ruled that the federal statute transferred criminal jurisdiction to Wisconsin, but not regulatory. And so that's why we're also hearing that the other 10 tribes are saying they may have a mechanism to do this as well.
Saying that marijuana growing and selling would fall under regulatory, not...
not prohibitory, right. Not criminal.
Hmm.
And so they argue that they would be able to do it as well. Now, obviously, Menominee's argument is the stronger one. But the others also have a argument. So that's why this is becoming so fascinating.
So we are talking about the Menominee tribe's vote to legalize recreational and medicinal marijuana use on the reservation. Let's turn back to Gary Bisaw, who's chairman of the Menominee tribe. Gary, you've said before, especially in light of the fact that the Menominee casino bid was rejected by Governor Walker, you said that the Menominee tribe can't turn its back on any potential revenue sources. How do you exactly see that growing and selling marijuana would be an economic benefit for the tribe?
Well, there's actually several benefits that we are researching. While economic may be of benefit, if you had seen the numbers regarding the two questions, whether the tribe should allow recreational use of cannabis for adults 21 or older, that passed at a 57.8% approval. But should the Menominee tribe allow the medicinal use of cannabis, passed at a resounding 76.5% approval. So the concept or the recognition that correctly monitored and controlled, there is medicinal value to marijuana for PTSD patients and veterans, for cancer patients, for chronic pain. I mean, I can't discount those or turn my back. I know those are real. But when we look at the whole concept of economic, originally, when we put this together, we put this advisory referendum. And by the way, when you couch this is an advisory referendum. It's not binding on the tribal legislature, but it's rather advisory in nature. So So, yeah, as I was saying, when we first put this out, we wanted to know, should we take our limited resources and commit more time and more effort into researching the development of tribal law, tribal ordinance, that speaks to either allowing recreational or medicinal use. So instead of using our limited resources, we said, first, let's get the temperature of the tribal members. Should we even do this before we commit more resources to it? And when we put this out originally, we did not know exactly the interpretation on the U.S. Department of Justice guidelines that our local U.S. Attorney General might have. One of those talks about you can't take it from a state that is legal into a state that's illegal. Well, we believe that interpretation, and each attorney general can interpret them differently, you know, that's allowed. They say that may not just be speaking geographically, so maybe not just from a physical place to another physical mm-hmm. place, but within our jurisdiction for victimless crimes, the state has jurisdiction over non-natives, even on the reservation. So
Gary, let me ask you something. Do you think that the Menominee tribe would even be considering this if the casino had been approved?
Considering the benefits of medicinal cannabis and our unique status, jurisdictional status, I think we would have. It would have removed the other argument about the need for additional revenue, but I think knowing the benefits medicinally, I think we would have.
And Gary, one last question for you before we let you go. So you made a point of saying that this was an advisory referendum. It did pass pretty strongly, especially for the medicinal use of marijuana. What's the next step for the tribe at this point?
Well, the next step is we need to really research from other jurisdictions what any laws that have been passed in other jurisdictions that have legalized that, what laws have been passed and their impact in whether it's economically, socially, medicinally. We need to look and cherry pick some of those best practices for ourselves to look at. We also need to speak with each of the legal entities that either have jurisdiction or would be impacted by a decision, and we need to put all of that as well as the U.S. Department of Justice guidelines into the development of these ordinances. And these are real formative. The tribal members will have input, but it's a long, drawn-out process. We're like any other legislative body. We have a very complicated system for legislation development. So, we see this as a long process. Whatever happens, we know that we need to make sure that the welfare of our community is not at risk. So it's going to be a cautious approach.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Gary.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
That was Gary Bisaw, chairman of the Menominee Tribe, joining us to talk about the tribe's decision to legalize marijuana use on their lands. We'll continue this conversation with legal expert Richard Monette.
And we want to hear from you. What is your reaction to the Menominee Tribe voting to legalize marijuana on their reservation? Do you have any questions for Richard about what legal issues could come up? And do you agree or disagree with their decision as it stands so far? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to law professor Richard Monette about the Menominee Tribe's vote to legalize marijuana on their lands this week.
And you can join the conversation. What's your reaction to the Menominee Tribe legalizing marijuana on their reservation? Do you have any questions for Richard about what legal issues might arise? In general, do you agree or disagree with the referendum decision? Let us know at 800-642-1234 or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, Richard, as you mentioned earlier, this decision is possible because of the different jurisdictions that are in play on tribal lands. But the decision of the Department of Justice under President Obama might change under a new president. How might a new presidential administration change things? Do they have power?
Sure. It's important to know that this is just a policy determination from the administration. Public Law 280 was not repealed. The marijuana laws were not repealed. And so in 15 months, we could have a new presidential administration that decides to come in and says, well, I'm sorry, but we are going to enforce these federal laws. Now, one of the points that Chairman Bisaw makes is fascinating here, actually, is the states and the tribes have become bedfellows here. They both are saying, we're pushing back against the federal government. We are sort of the old Newt Gingrich line, that we're closer and more accountable to the people. And the states and the tribes are both saying that. So when the states have been pushing back and legalizing marijuana in the face of federal laws, you know, the department is now and will be, no matter who the president is, sort of confronted with that rather difficult sort of question. So what do we do about the Indian tribes that are surrounded by these states that are legalizing it, right? And so to me, this is just a fascinating exercise, and really not just in law, but in political theory, watching our federalism work, watching sort of a parallel federalism between the states and the Fed and the tribes and the Fed. It's just been fascinating. And so, it's going to get better.
So part of it is decisions on how much, what a priority it is or isn't to enforce these laws. But what if a new presidential, well, there will be a new presidential administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican, what options are available for changing the policy itself, not just saying this is a priority or this is a low priority?
Well, it will be, and on the one hand, easy with the sweep of the hand to change policy. What will be difficult will be to treat the tribes differently than they're treating the states. And so if there's a pushback against the tribes, we're assuming, I think rightfully, that there will be a pushback against the states that have been sort of thumping their states' rights chest and legalizing marijuana. Mm-hmm. So they're going to go hand in hand here, and that's not usually the way it happens.
I think one of the interesting things about this is that, of course, there's the question of, will this marijuana be available on the tribal lands just to tribal members or to people from the surrounding area, the non-tribal people that live nearby or come to the reservation? And it's interesting because this seems to be very similar to casinos. I mean, obviously, it is not just Native Americans who are going to Indian casinos. It's everyone. And so does that set something of a precedent?
This is a thicket of Rubik's Cube proportions here. So the analogy to gaming, I think, is appropriate. If the state says, well, our citizens will have sort of state law following them onto the Menominee Reservation, and if it's illegal in the state, you won't go to Menominee and buy it or use it or anything. So if that flies, then what about gambling? Can the state then say, citizens of the state of Wisconsin, we don't care if Menominee can have a casino under federal law. If you go there and use their casino, it's a crime, right? Mm-hmm. there are some fascinating inconsistencies, or maybe consistencies, coming up with this discussion. In some ways, I can't wait.
Although it is interesting, because I think probably one of the concerns is that if marijuana, especially recreational marijuana, is sold on a reservation, it's a lot easier to carry a baggie of recreational marijuana off of the reservation than, say, to carry a slot machine out of a casino.
That's a fair analogy, but it's also probably just as fair to say it's a lot easier to carry legal marijuana from another state when they get around to it, like Minnesota, than it will be from a reservation. In my opinion, even though the reservations are right in our midst, non-Indians going back and forth across, especially that border at Menominee, maybe not so much at Oneida, but that border, that's a relatively discreet action. But, you know, that's different from coming across from Minnesota, where every, you know, hundreds of thousands of people come across every week.
Let's go to the phones, and Jack in Antioch, Illinois is up first. Hi, Jack.
Hi. First of all, I think this is a fascinating topic, and I want to be very specific. There's no gray area in my thinking. I'm 100% behind the Menominee Tribes Initiative. I just read an account by Simon Winchester about Wounded Knee. And it was such a tragic situation, and it reminded me what my mom taught me. We broke every treaty you can possibly imagine with the First Nations or the Native American Indian tribes, and I am 100% in favor of this very thoughtful initiative behind the Menominee tribe in this regard. I think it's about time we do more for these First Nation peoples in this country. And there's no gray area in my thinking. It's 100% in favor.
All right. Well, thank you for that comment, Jack. And let's stay on the phones and go to Ben in Toma next. Hi, Ben.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to call in and say excited I was about this conversation. I'm a dialysis kidney disease patient that moved to Colorado to you know, participate with medical marijuana for medical reasons, and I just think it's very positive that it's coming to the state of Wisconsin, and that I'm proud of the, you know, the Native American population for taking up that cause. And that's really what I wanted to say. I also agree with the gentleman that called before, and that, you know, we definitely broke a lot of treaties with the Native Americans, and it's about time they and pick something up and do something for themselves, and I'm very proud of them for doing this. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ben. And Richard Monette, actually, the two calls kind of brought up different aspects of the issue. So the Menominee had two different referenda, and one was for medical, medicinal marijuana, and one was for recreational. Would those two functions or uses of marijuana fall under different jurisdictions or different policies?
I think, excuse me, I think it's safe to say that they will not and they should not fall under different policies. But you and I both know that there are different policy considerations transporting medicinal marijuana across the borders and, you know, getting it into the stream of commerce where, in fact, it is used, including in Wisconsin, as opposed to, you know, having recreational drugs going across the borders. So, well, like it or not, that's going to be a factor. But for the basic lay of the land, the jurisdiction should not change.
But if that's the case, why have two separate referenda, or why treat them differently?
Well, I don't think that they did this advisory referenda for us. I think they did it for them. So their people wanted to make the decision whether they would have recreational, you know, use laws, possession, growing, etc., in their midst, or whether they would ensure that their government has maintained tighter controls, probably certified, licensed, you know, single dispensary from the tribe, etc. Mm-hmm. So it was more for them than for us.
So in just a minute or so we have left, what are we going to be looking at for doing, what's going to be the next step for the tribe in determining if it's legal or not?
I think since the advisory passed that their legislature has gotten to work already figuring out what they're going to do here, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Richard Monette, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Richard Monette, a law professor, talking about the Menominee Tribe's referenda on legalizing marijuana on their reservation.